Future Proof Extra from News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof Extra. My name is Jonathan McRae. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. And this is a slightly different format for this week's Extra because the last podcast episode that's in your feed is Chances, our doc that we put out last week. So we're getting to your usual stuff here, looking through emails and tweets and playing you the normal sort of feature that you hear on Future Proof. So later on in the podcast, Dr. Jennifer Cleary will be talking about warp bubbles. I haven't heard that piece, so I have literally no idea what that's about, but I presume it's something to do with space. But in the meantime, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me in studio is Dr. Lorna Salmon from UCD and Philip Smith, broadcaster and science communicator. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Okay, maybe we can take it down just a little. I think you're going to screw the other pregnant women.
Are you kidding me?
Okay.
Are you kidding me?
That brings back some memories, that sound. It's about babies.
Yes, so this study is about women who give birth assisted by forceps or suction cups. One in five.
Do they still use suction cups?
They do, apparently.
Isn't that so weird and slightly, I mean, like, it's not barbaric, obviously, because it works, but it sort of feels like I'm going to just put a plunger on your baby's head and suck that right out of there. I mean, like, it's just strange.
Apparently, well, I couldn't find a statistic on Ireland, but 12.5% of births in the UK.
Or one in eight to a non-scientist.
There you go.
So this is about giving antibiotics to people who aren't necessarily infected. Why would you do that? I thought we were trying to get rid of antibiotics and reduce the amount of antibiotics that we're using.
So this study found that for every 100 doses that you give to someone before infection, you reduce the amount of infection so much that you, I suppose, reduce the amount of antibiotics used by 168. So you can see that it's kind of a snowball effect in some senses. So if you stop the infection before it comes, you actually end up using less antibiotics.
That's sort of kind of weird. So you're giving more antibiotics than we do normally to prevent that. And so the idea of the study is to find out when to give that antibiotic?
Yes. So in this study, they gave the antibiotic up to 6 hours after birth. And this reduced the infection by half, the infection rate by half. So basically, they're trying to figure out, should we give the antibiotic, which was amoxicillin, should we give it to them before birth? Should we give it to them after birth? Should it be long after birth? So they're trying to figure out exactly when to reduce that infection rate by as much as possible.
Well, that's pretty significant findings. And like anything that eases the situation in the first 3 months of having a baby, I mean, the idea that you could have a tear and you've got to deal with everything else you have to deal with, and also you can't sit down. I mean, I really do feel for women post-pregnancy, particularly when that thing happens. So that's quite interesting. Our second story, Philip, has to do with a space goldfish. This is like fearing the death of the sun for me. This is worries about a space gold rush in the future.
Well, yeah, I know, but the first thing to do before anything with this, with a gold rush in the title, is to yee-haw and get straight into it. Because
I told you before we did this,
no,
I don't yee-haw. I said it's corny. People are going to say, Philip, you're corny.
I know, but that's me.
Right.
I delivered.
Okay, you've got your yee-haw over with. Tell me the story.
Well, the story is actually, I find really interesting, because it's about curating space effectively. So scientists from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Massachusetts.
Easy for you to say.
Not at all, and I slurred over it. Are saying that they want to preserve large areas of space and present them as an official space wilderness. So they want to knock off 85% of space and say that it should be absolved from any kind of mining or industrial exploitation activity. And if you kind of think of this, like in Ireland, we have national parks, natural reserves, listed buildings even. It's protecting the things that we need to protect. And this is what they're saying, because there are actual companies already looking at this. It was one of the ones I looked at in the UK called the Asteroid Mining Corporation, really inventive name. They want to start sending up a satellite up to nearby asteroids, because there are trillions of dollars up in space just waiting to be plucked, is how they kind of portray it on their website.
I am envisaging people on the street with placards like, keep your asses off our asteroids and paws off Pluto. And that, like, this, the idea that this is something we need to worry about. Well, the idea that, you know, that pretty soon people are going to be traveling to the asteroid belt to bring back large pieces of heavy metal to then sell on the open market. It's just, it's ridiculous.
It's not necessarily, but there's two things in that. One, that, okay, sometimes you can tackle a problem once it arrives, or you can preemptively look at what you should do so that problem doesn't arrive.
We're great at that.
Well, yeah, we're not, but this is trying to actually prevent that. So Martin Elvis, who's an astrophysicist looking at this, is that if we say and think about this now, then we won't behave like we've done all the time. We won't have to be in a few hundred years looking at a cleanup. The other thing is that we're not necessarily...
He's an optimist, I would say. Hopefully, he's a glass half full sort of guy.
He's the kind of guy who's looking at this going, look, I need to take action. And he's trying to do that. And he's working with philosophers as well, Tony Milligan about it from King's College, to really kind of portray why we should be doing this. The other thing to think about is that we're not looking to bring all these minerals back to Earth. What we're also trying to look at is materials in space to build our future in space, potentially. So you're looking
at... But again, this is like so far in the future. You're talking like an iron ore refining facility that we have somehow built on an asteroid in space. Like, we're talking about... there are other things we need to worry about. And the other thing is, you know, all of these, like, cautionary missives from scientists over the past 10 years, completely ignored. You know, don't genetic baby anything.
Don't genetic baby anything. Scientists said, don't genetic
That's
baby
That's exactly
anything.
What they said. Don't genetic baby anything. They said, don't make robot... guns. Don't be doing the fracking. All of these things, like, we just go, yeah, that's interesting. Thanks very much. I'm just going to go and frack now. Is that all right?
You need people to actually identify. Oh, without any great movement always comes, or a great journey starts with one step. And maybe this guy is the first step in that process to protecting it. Also leads back to, if you're looking at what's out there and what we need to do to protect space, it infers what we've done with the Earth as well. So it proliferates. It's building on knowledge that's already been there in existence. We do need this stuff. We need fuel in space. You're looking at water can be broken down into hydrogen and oxygen that can act as fuel in space. We don't have to fly it up. We don't have to waste more of Earth's resources to get up there and do all this other stuff. This is a good idea. It's starting early. In 10 years is when they're trying to... Now, this is potentially, again, the PR company from the asteroid mining company, but they're looking at in 10 years where they think their first potential mission could be at.
Yeah, but they're not going to bring anything back.
This is the first step.
All I'm saying, I'm all for sticking roses down the barrels of tanks, but, like, this is not where we are right now, right?
No, it's not. But these conversations need to happen now so we don't wreck our future up there.
I absolutely believe in philosophy, but I don't think we should get too worried about it. Our third story has to do with mind control hearing aids, Lana.
Yeah, so the current hearing aids that are out there, they have a big flaw, which is that they amplify all sounds. And this leads to what's called the cocktail party effect, where you're in a really loud room, but you can hear everything. You can hear the background noise, you can hear the person talking to you, but you're not able to focus on any one sound because they're all so loud. And so this hearing aid focuses on just one voice and is able to amplify that voice. And it does that using your brain.
I don't know if people have ever tried a hearing aid. I lost a large part of my hearing in the 90s due to stupidity and also DJing in nightclubs without any protection. And how I would deal with the large sound of a nightclub in my left ear is I would make the right ear even louder. So I went and tried out one of these hearing aids, and it's an awful thing because, as you're absolutely right, it's a weird thing. It amplifies all sound. It's kind of like listening to a microphone in the wild with headphones on. You realize, oh, there's so much more sound here. Our brain sort of actively does this mixing, right? And with a hearing aid, it's almost negated in a way. You get this sort of wall of, like, unpleasant noises, like the hum of a freezer and that sort of stuff. So the idea behind this is, it allows you to, do you have to press buttons and choose what you're going to listen to, or how does it work?
No, so as you said, the brain is able to pick a sound or a voice and is able to amplify that itself if your ear is acting the way it should. So the idea behind this is that when you are focusing on one voice or one sound, your brain creates brain waves which are very similar to the sound wave of that voice.
Yeah.
And so the hearing aid, you put an electrode in your brain, so it's a bit invasive, just a little bit.
it sounds pretty pleasant.
It's fine.
Yeah, go for it.
Totally fine.
And this detects the brain waves. And the hearing aid is listening for the voices outside. And if it hears a voice which a sound wave which is the same as the brain wave in your brain, well, then it will amplify that sound and that sound only.
Ah, okay. So basically, you choose what to concentrate on. And so it hears you. If you're concentrating on something, it will amplify that and not the other things.
Exactly.
So yeah, but that's really interesting. So when you're listening and focusing on a certain sound, your brain recreates that brainwave and you can turn that up or down.
That's it.
Is this tested in mice or...
No, so this is tested in humans. This was tested in epilepsy patients.
I knew you were going to say that. Epilepsy patients. Like the gifts they have given to medicine and been completely unappreciated. So if you have epilepsy,
you're going to get
many
tested.
Times in the yeah. program, they open your skull and as a result, and they put in electrodes to monitor your epilepsy. And as soon as you agree to do that, I guarantee you some neuroscientist is going to pop his head around the corner. Excuse me, listen, why are you getting that done? Do you mind if I do 50 different tests in your brain? So look, fair dues. I get a little bit.
Absolutely.
Thank you to epilepsy patients everywhere for helping us understand the brain. So we've tested this in humans. So it does work.
Yes. And they say that in 5 years, they'll make it less invasive. So
okay.
They want to put a sensor under the skin and the skull. And they also want to put it in the ear and test that instead of putting an electrode in the brain. So
does this mean that if you can pick and focus on particular sounds that you could be like in a crowd and go, I want to listen to their conversation and just like decide, like so like a spy or a superhero kind of go, I just want to listen to that.
So this is one of the applications that they list in their paper. Yes. So they want to...
Ah.
For military
they list it in their application. What?
Yeah. Military funding, please.
Yeah.
Exactly. They say that you'd be able to listen to conversations that are far away from you.
Wow.
Wow.
Awesome.
Very cool. Thank you very much. That is Philip Smith, science communicator, and Lana Salmon from UCD's Space Science Group. Dr. Salmon will be speaking at Pint of Science on
Tuesday the 21st at 7 o'clock in the Mercantile.
Talking about Ireland's first ever satellite.
Yes.
Exciting, and you can see her. And I was going to
say, you can
see her. That's all
there.
You're allowed to do at Pint of Science.
To her. Yeah,
them's the
it.
Rules. It's
There's
sort of
glass
like a
wall.
It's like a lap dancing club. All you're allowed to do is look.
No,
it's nothing like
That's
that.
Back, no.
In fact, I'm backing away quickly. Thank you both.
There are some irrefutable truths that are known to exist. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction, and nothing can exceed the speed of light. Despite what we might wish for ourselves in the future, travelling to distant planets still remains somewhat of a dream. Simply put, we will never have the capacity to reach those far-flung planets. Or will we? Dr. Miguel Alcubierre, a theoretical physicist working at the Nuclear Sciences Institute of the National Autonomous University of Mexico, joins me now. Miguel, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, thank you for the call.
So just before we get started, just for a little bit of context, can you tell our listeners a little bit about Einstein's special theory of relativity?
Yeah, well, this is by now it's a very old theory, even though many of the conclusions still sound very strange. It's something Einstein developed in 1905 when he was thinking about what would happen when objects travel very fast. In particular, when they travel close to the speed of light. And when he was thinking about that, he realized that many of the things we actually understood about physics were wrong. And Newtonian physics failed when we were traveling very, very fast. And when he did the math, very curious things happened. It turned out that space and time are relative. So what we think of distances depends on the observer, on the speed of the observer. What we think of as time also depends on the speed of the observer. So the flow of time is not constant. It depends on how fast you're moving. And things like that, which is why the theory is called the theory of relativity, because all these things turned out to be relative to your speed. But other things turn out to be absolute. For example, in his theory, the speed of light is an absolute. It's the same no matter who measures it and how fast you're traveling when you measure it. And also it turns out that the speed of light is the maximum speed in the universe allowed. Nothing can travel faster than light. No form of physical influence. It doesn't just apply to spaceships. It's nothing, not even any form of energy field. Nothing can travel faster than light. And this is something that he discovered in 1905. And by now we know it's completely true because we've never seen anything travel faster than light. And we've done many, many experiments and we've observed the universe and galaxies and everything like that. And nothing travels faster than light. Einstein was right. So this is basically the essence of his theory is what happens when you travel very, very fast and how the world looks when you travel fast. And this conclusion that nothing can travel faster than light is one of the strongest points of his theory.
Okay, so we can't travel faster than light. And then the faster through space we travel, kind of we travel slower through time. Is that right?
Well, if you go very, very fast, time appears to go slower for you. So somebody's moving very fast with respect to you, you will see that all his clocks go slow. You will essentially see them in slow motion. And if somebody can travel exactly at the speed of light, then you would see them frozen in time. So if you could go at the speed of light precisely, then time wouldn't flow. You would be frozen in time. Time would stop. And if you could travel faster than light, then in principle, time would go backwards, which makes no sense, which is one of the reasons why you cannot travel faster than light.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. You can't make time go backwards. So how are we going to get to these far-flung planets? For example, say Alpha Centauri, 4.4 light years away. How long would that take us now? With the technology we have now, how long would it take us?
The technology we have now, the fastest spaceship we've ever built, didn't have any people. It's one of these probes, the Voyager probe, that was sent out in the 70s to visit the outer planets in the solar system. That one is going at around 40 or 50,000 kilometers per hour, which is the fastest speed anything we've ever built has done. And at that speed, it would take you about 70,000 years to get to Alpha Centauri. 70,000 years.
70,000 years. So that's
exactly.
That's not possible. That's not going to happen.
That's absurd, yeah.
So how can we get there? How can we get to these far-flung planets?
Well, the thing is that it turns out there's a loophole. We're not exactly sure you can actually use it, but there are loopholes. Einstein developed another theory in 1915, 10 years later, which again, for confusing reasons, is called again, relativity, but this one is called the general theory of relativity, not the special one, but the general theory of relativity. And in this theory, he actually talks about gravity. So this was a new theory of gravity, fully compatible with his previous special relativity. It turned out to be a very complicated theory mathematically, but the basic idea of the theory is that Einstein realized that gravity is not actually a force as we are used to thinking about it. It's more like a deformation of space and time. So gravity deforms or curves space and also affects the flow of time. So this deformation of space, we normally just perceive it as a force of gravity, but it has very important effects. For example, it has to do with the origin of the universe. It has to do with things like black holes. All these things come out of Einstein's theory of relativity, of general relativity. And if you can deform space and time, then you can do very crazy things. You can deform it in very, very strange ways. For example, you could produce some kind of shortcut. You can make a shortcut in the universe that would take you from here to Alpha Centauri very, very fast because you're not going through normal space. You're going through a shortcut made from curvature of space.
And then
you could do it very fast.
And is that like a wormhole, those shortcuts?
Exactly.
In
that
space
would be what we call a wormhole. So wormholes actually allowed in the theory of Einstein. Einstein himself discovered the first wormhole in the 1930s in a paper he wrote with a colleague named Nathan Rosen. And we've had this, they didn't call it a wormhole then, and in the physical literature, they usually call Einstein-Rosen bridges. But today we call them wormholes, it's the same thing.
Okay.
And these things are allowed in principle in his theory. We don't know how to build one, but they're in principle not forbidden. And this was an idea that was there for a long time. And in principle, there's no problem. So you can sort of cheat Einstein using Einstein, right? You can deform space to cheat the original theory of Einstein. You wouldn't be going faster than light, because if light goes through the wormhole, it would still beat you, right? It goes faster than you. But you would be going through a shortcut. So that's one way to travel in principle faster than the speed of light. Now, another way, which is what I came up with this idea in 1994, is the problem with wormholes is that you need to make a hole in space. Make a hole in space and connect it to someone very far away. And we don't know how to make holes in space. Nobody has a clue how to do that. So I came up with a very different idea. And this is based on the fact that we know that the universe is expanding. We've known that since the 20s, we've known that for almost 100 years. And everybody's probably heard about the expansion of the universe sometime, right? About the Big Bang Theory and things like that. Well, it turns out that when we talk about the expansion of the universe, we don't really mean that the galaxies are just flying away from each other very, very fast. It's not like that. The expansion of the universe is different. The galaxies are actually sitting still in space, but space between them is stretching, it's expanding. So they're not actually moving, but the space between them grows. This is the way we understand it according to the theory of Einstein. So space can expand.
Okay, so the planets themselves are stationary. It's the space between them that's moving, and that's why the universe is expanding.
Exactly, yeah, the galaxies are. So the space between them grows. And this is allowed in the theory. Space can be contracted, it can be expanded, it can be stretched and curved, and you can do many things with space. So this is the way we understand it. And the idea I came up with, instead of having an expansion of the whole universe, why don't we think in small scale and think that somehow we create an expansion of space in a small region behind you? that would push you away from whatever you have behind you. And at the same time, you produce an opposite contraction of space in a small region in front of you. And that would pull you towards whatever is in front of you. And these two effects combined would move you around. But in fact, you're not moving. You're sitting there static, but space is changing and it's pushing you around. And the interesting thing is that there's no limit about how fast this can be done. There's no limit to the speed at which space can expand. You can do it in principle at any large speed. And in principle, you can even do it faster than light. And there's nothing, no problem. There's no contradiction.
I know that this makes perfect sense to you, but do you have
an
analogy to describe this?
Yeah, there's an analogy. You can think of it, for example, if you go to an airport and you see a travelator, one of these moving bands in airports. So you stand in the band and you're just standing there, but you're moving. You're not moving yourself. It's the floor, the one that's moving. And behind you, floor is coming out of nowhere. Well, we know it's coming out from below, but if you didn't know, you would think that floor is being created behind you and floor is being destroyed in front of you, and in the middle you're moving, right? So this is something similar to what the idea I have in mind about space travel.
Oh, so you want to create like a space travelator?
Basically, yes. And you expand space behind you and you contract it in front of you, and that pushes you around. This would be sort of a bubble of deformed space, and you would be sitting in the middle of the bubble. And in the behind you in the bubble walls, space would be created, and in front of you in the bubble walls, it would be destroyed. And that pushes you around. And you can do it as fast as you want. In fact, we know this sort of thing happens at least at the scale of the universe. Many people, when you talk about the expansion of the universe, and if you think a little bit, they come to the conclusion that, well, if galaxies are moving faster the further away they are from you, then if they're sufficiently far away, in principle, they should be moving away from you faster than the speed of light. And that's true. And then they say, well, this contradicts relativity. Well, it doesn't contradict relativity because this is relativity. This is Einstein's theory. So, and this happens. We know that this happens. A galaxy is sufficiently far away from us, very, very far away. It moves away from us faster than light because space can expand faster than light, no problem. So this is the idea I had, and I published this in 1994. I call it the warp ride, and I use the warp ride. I didn't invent it, of course. I took the name from science fiction, for Star Trek, because I thought that my idea was very similar to whatever they're supposed to be doing in Star Trek.
So you got this idea. You got this idea of space travel from Star Trek.
I did, yeah.
That's amazing. I love that.
I was watching an episode of Star Trek, The New Generation, The Next Generation, when I was doing my PhD, and I had the idea then.
I love this. This is brilliant. How could people travel through this kind of warp bubble? Or would it have to be an unmanned spaceship?
No, in principle, people could do it inside the bubble. So you wouldn't go through the bubble. You would be sitting inside the bubble and the bubble would be moving. But yeah, there's no problem. A person could be inside the bubble, no problem. The problem is a different one. If you want to deform space and create a deformation, a curvature of space, there's a price to pay. As I mentioned at the beginning, a deformation and a curvature of space is what we call gravity. And gravity is produced by large concentrations of mass or large concentrations of energy. So say the sun or the earth or a black hole. So these very large concentrations of mass produce gravity and they deform space. So there's a set of equations. We call them the Einstein equations. They're actually very complicated mathematically. But it's a set of equations that relates how space is deformed on the one hand, and on the other hand, how much energy and mass you need to produce that deformation. And when you apply those equations to this idea of the warp drive, or even to the wormholes we discussed before, something very strange happens. You discover that in order to create this deformation of space, you need something we call negative energy, which maybe doesn't sound very strange, but remember that mass and energy are equivalent because Einstein taught us E=mc². So when I talk about negative energy, I really mean negative mass. And negative mass is something very strange. We just never heard of negative mass.
Yeah, because everything has
the masses
mass.
Are positive. And as far as we know, negative mass doesn't exist. So if it doesn't exist, we can't create the warp drive. We can't make wormholes because we would need this negative mass. So that's the main problem. If it doesn't exist, then we can never do it. But if it does, if it turns out it exists, then in principle we could do these things. It's not actually forbidden. There's no law in physics that says negative mass can't exist. It's just that we've never seen it.
And are we trying to create negative energy or negative mass? Is that ongoing?
Not directly, because we don't really know how to make it. So in principle, we don't know. There's very small hints that maybe very small, minute amounts of negative energy can exist. that come from quantum theory. When you study quantum physics, you realize that in some regions of space, in very special circumstances, you can have a very small amount of negative energy. And this comes from dealing with the quantum vacuum, but the details are a bit complicated, but in principle, it's there. The problem with that is that the amount of negative mass you can get from these special circumstances is so small that you wouldn't be able to do anything with that. It's really, really ridiculously small. But in principle, it exists. So that gives me a little bit of hope.
I mean, you make great arguments for it. You know, you go through the laws, you go through the theories, and you say how each of them show that this is a possibility. So my last question for you is, do you think this is actually possible? I understand that in theory it is. It doesn't break any laws of physics. Do you think this is actually possible? And do you think it was you'd see in your lifetime?
It's an excellent question. In my lifetime, no, not for sure. I mean, if this is ever possible, it's going to take us centuries. Even if we have centuries, do I think it's possible? I'm not sure. I'm a bit pessimistic. I think it's probably not possible. I think negative energy probably doesn't exist in large enough amounts, and we probably can't control it. But I'm not sure. I mean, we never know. It's a possibility. It's still open. But even if it does exist, it's something we won't be able to do for centuries. But no, not in my lifetime, unfortunately.
And not in mine either. Miguel, thank you so much for coming on and explaining some very complicated laws and theories in a way that we can understand. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Jennifer Cleary from when I was away on my travels in Argentina. Very interesting stuff. Let us know what you think. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. Now, last week we were talking about the sort of depletion of the species, and Robert in Wexford says there is currently, I presume he means currently, he says here correctly, I presume he means currently, there are currently 2,000 megawatts of ground-mounted solar with full planning permission granted that could be deployed in generating clean electricity within 2 years, but the government have dragged their heels on introducing the support scheme in order to meet our carbon emissions target and avoiding the European fines coming in 2020 at an estimated 250 to 350 million euro. Declaring an environmental emergency is one thing, taking action is something else. Absolutely agree. And you know, if you look at the number of people in Parliament, in the Dáil, when this climate emergency was announced, there was about 9 TDs there. So I don't know if that's representative of the sort of support at TD level, but it does go to show that it's not representative of what I believe the public feels about this, which is they want something to happen. But I'm not quite sure I understand, Robert. Are you saying that the ground-mounted solar has been halted that would have helped with our carbon emissions target? If you know more than me, you might clarify that for me. Kevin in Galway says, what we could do to prevent loss of biodiversity is to set up a marine reserve somewhere along our coast. This would become a tourist attraction as well as boost the fishing stocks after it has been established for a number of years. Yeah, I think there is, there's definite merit for monetizing the whale watching a bit more. There are places you can do whale watching. It's an extraordinary activity if you get to do it. I do think ecotourism could be a thing here, but we don't have the sort of warm water and, you know, we don't have the pretty fish hanging around, do we?
Yeah, but New Zealand have a lot of ecotourism. And actually, when you think about wildlife in New Zealand, it's not all that spectacular. Like, they don't have the largest mammals they have are like sheep and things like that. And they're all not obviously native to that region, but they still do a really good job of putting people towards like green spaces, marine reserves, yeah. You know, making a big deal about small fish and small and birds and stuff.
Yeah. I guess, you know, I've been on sort of nature trails and walks and stuff. And like sometimes like in Argentina, you know, you're walking on this nature trail and it's like, oh my God, there's fireflies. And then, oh my goodness, that is a crocodile. And then it's, oh, that's a wolf, and like this is a trip we went on in the swamplands, and it was like, oh my God, there's a wild ostrich, and you're like, wait a minute, this is insane. And that's the sort of stuff that I kind of, you know, when I go on a, you know, a nature walk or a kind of, you know, eco reserve, you sort of expect to see, I don't know, some sexy animals, you know.
Whales and dolphins.
Whales
are sexy.
And dolphins are, but other than that, what have we got? What have we got in the seas? Some crappy crabs. I don't know. It's like we've got to.
Poor crabs.
Let's just introduce some, you know, some strange. Like, why don't we introduce a giant squid? Like that would sell out. That would, you'd have people coming all over the place. We were speaking about nuts, and I was saying, because apparently if you eat nuts in the first trimester, kids are going to be smarter. So says a small study that, you know, really needs more work before we can say is absolutely applicable. But they seem to say on three different types of cognition tests, in a study in Spain, if you eat nuts, kids are going to be smarter. Gillian and I said, I was like, in Spain, they eat nuts all the time, but they sort of spit them out, don't they? They have these shells everywhere. I remember them as a teenager going through the, you know, the student exchange, and like everyone was just spitting these nuts on the ground. And Gillian says, oh, Jesus, Jonathan, they're sunflower seeds eaten and the husks are spread out in the ground, not nuts. Indeed they are. She says, 'tis terrible to see my heroes stumbling in feet of clay. You know what? I'm going to take some solace in the word heroes. But yes, indeed.
And ignore feet of clay.
I was factually incorrect. We got a text in. We're talking about beards being sexy. And someone says, the only people with beards these days obviously are effeminate, gay, and advertising investments. And advertising and investments are in quotes. Beware of social Darwinism. I literally have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, I would tackle it and say this is like whatever it is. I just don't know what you mean. It sounds like offensive, but I don't know. It's like some of those words that haven't yet, you know, gotten definition. It sounds like it should be offensive, but I don't know what he means.
Sounds to me like our listener really wishes he had a fulsome beard.
Aiden turned up last week, by the way, beardless, and it was really unsettling. I, in fact, and this is no joke, created a small mask and with pinhole pricks in an A4 sheet so that when I looked through it, I only half saw his face because it was so weird speaking to him without the full beard. It's now half beard, and it's just, you're like Aiden's nephew who's come in to do some work experience. It's really weird seeing you without the full beard. I find it really, I don't know, like psychologically really distressing. I don't know why.
Well, I woke up in the morning after the beard was gone, and it was like looking in the mirror at your teenage self, which was kind of weird and Hollywood-esque.
What would you have said to your teenage self?
You're doing great.
Grow a f***ing beard is what you would have
nailed.
Said. Don't ever, you are winning in life. Right. I guess that's wrapping up this podcast, Rooney. We will be back with more Future Proof. I think Future Proof Gold next, yeah? The regular Future Proof is on hold next week because of our rolling election coverage. If you're in Ireland, don't miss it. If you're not in Ireland, honestly, it's quite boring. I'm kidding. I just mean, like, if you're not involved, if you're not invested in it, it would be boring. Like, why would you ever listen to the rolling election coverage of another country when it's county councillors? Although I have found this whole process quite interesting. And European elections. But we haven't got the whole Nigel Farage thing going on. Although we do. We have. Not going to say anymore. Not
going to
say anymore.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe you've got a vested interest in how the European candidates are doing in Ireland. Look, we do it well. That's all I can say. Whether or not the content is suited for you, only you can. I'm really babbling here. Well, let's just wrap up the podcast. Aidan McKelvey was producing. Simon Keane was researching on the sound. Either Peter Malloy or Jojo Cardozo. I don't have visibility of that right now. So just give them both a warm round of applause. We'll be back with more Future Proof Gold in the podcast feed where you found this. If you liked it, tell other people. In the meantime, stay curious.